generally speaking, what I'm inviting you to do is to think about some concept that's relevant to the Buddhist Dharma or something about your meditation practice. With the meditation practice, I can sort of be a coach, maybe make some suggestions about your practice. And otherwise, be glad to answer any questions that I can about the Dharma. Who's going to go first? All right, Mary.
My question comes from the book, The Stepping Out of Self-Deception. And I'm just going to read a little small paragraph. So, to discover our entry point into the vertical question of the heart, we need only know our spiritual inclination. What word or phrase calls our heart out of hiding? What word offers the satisfaction of rest? And then it goes on to say the word is usually individually determined and therefore cannot be given by another. And so this is something that I've been pondering, and I would say that an example of a word that makes me feel, calls to me in a restful way is like sunset. So the word sunset means something to me in calling me into rest. So my question is, I may not know exactly why yet, but is that kind of a possibility to, if you have a word that seems to do something to you, is that kind of what that advice is suggesting?
Well, he uses the word inclination. Another way to describe that is intention. Intention is one of the functions of the mind that organizes or orients our attention towards some sort of action. Every moment has an intention. Now, usually, intentions are dominated by distraction, by craving and clinging. So it's useful to have one target, an object to rest your attention on, let your attention soak into. Mindfulness of breathing is the most commonly referred to in the Buddhist world. But, mantra certainly works. And that kind of word for you, sunset, can provide that. It's a stabilizing point of reference. My assumption is the word sunset, as you said, has some quality of peacefulness associated with it. And along with that peacefulness can come clarity. The longer you can stay without distraction, kind of breathing through that word, sunset, I would associate it with the process of breathing. Maybe on the in-breath, kind of say to yourself, sun, on the out-breath, set, or something that works for you. But it's all about the intention, what organizes your focus of attention and action. And that will stabilize your mind. When your mind jumps track away from sunset, away from the breath, then you notice it and let it go. Go back to sunset. Now, this another technique that's honored over the centuries is counting. One on the in-breath, two on the out-breath, three on the in-breath, up to 10, or until you get distracted. Then you start over again. One on the in-breath, two on the out-breath, has the same kind of function. It facilitates the intention to stabilize your focus of attention. And after a while, you won't need the saying in you, the word anymore, sunset. The mind becomes quiet and clear. And when the mind is quiet and clear, it's unhindered. That's the doorway into the vertical in the context of what is in the book. For those of you who don't know, one of the core concepts of this book, Stepping Out of Self-Deception, is by Rodney Smith, is the notion of the vertical and the horizontal. The horizontal is one's lived experience, memories, plans, whatever. The vertical is present moment, unhindered awareness. So the vertical is kind of, if you can imagine that, when you've seen one of those, I forget what they call them, but there's this an image on a screen, a little line that's jumping up and down, like with a heartbeat or something like that. If you can imagine that you're the horizontal aspect of the line is the horizontal. When the mind, when one of those little part of that signal spikes up, just think of that as the vertical, right? But the vertical, the characteristics of the vertical is that there's no craving and clinging involved. And without, when the craving and clinging is not controlling things, the mind is relatively free from craving and clinging. Is that helpful, Mary?
So I then would ask, or just say that the sunset that is meaningful to me in particular, it's not a one particular sunset, but it's a type of sunset in a wintry landscape. And it's from my lived experience. But it's not like it's just something that always called to me growing up, and I never knew why. And so when I say sunset, is it okay that it's something from my lived experience?
Well, the imagery, when, especially when it's retained in memory, usually has some kind of association. And the association could either be pleasant or unpleasant, or it can be neutral. Sensation of breathing is neutral for the most part. I'm assuming that your kind of semi-visual memory of sunset has a positive emotional effect, that your mind can be calm when that memory comes up, that word. Because the word, once it, like I said, there's some kind of association between the word itself or an image that you describe with a word, and some kind of emotional tone. So the main thing is that the intention is to stabilize your attention in a way that is tranquil. And then that's the vertical. Does that clarify?
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any spin-off questions from that or other interesting topics? This is great fun for me, by the way. Speak louder, please, Val.
Yes. Can you tell us how exactly you meditate? I know you told us in the past that you do full body scan, but can you give us more details about that?
Sure. Val wants me to describe my practice technique, I guess, the craft.
Yes, the actual thing.
Right. So I usually sit cross-legged. I'm saying this because there some people may be listening to this and sometime and not be able to see me. I'm sitting cross-legged usually. I can do this in a, any kind of posture, but usually I sit cross-legged. And I intentionally focus my attention on the sensation of breathing. And that's changed over the years. Some for some years it was the expansion and contraction of my abdomen. During another period, it's the sensation right around the rim of the nostrils. The last year or so, maybe longer, it's been the touch sensation that occurs when you breathe in through the nostrils, when the tongue is not pressed against the roof of the mouth, when the air goes down to the lungs, some of it swirls in and touches the inside of the gum, the upper jaw, and also the inside of the upper lip. So for me, that's a very vivid experience. It's easy for me to stay with that. It's harder to stay with the sensation around the nostrils. So I do that. Now,
When you breathe in, but when you breathe out,
same thing. Same
it's
thing happens when the air comes up out of your lungs. Some of it's going to swirl in there and touch that area. So now I don't particularly do this right now, but this does happen for me on retreats. What I will pay attention to is that the whole lip becomes a vibratory field, the meat of the lip from the inside to the outside. There's just a sensational. A vivid sensational experience there that is going on whether the in-breath or the out-breath is happening. So I bring my attention to that intentionally, same thing I was talking about with Mary. And then I start to systematically, after I do that for a little while, I mean, it might take me a couple of days to get to this level of facility, but the I'll start to move my attention around my face. Upper lip, lower lip, palate, the roof of the mouth, tongue, skin around my jaw, the cheekbones, temporal area, my ears, up around the eye sockets, the nose, forehead, top of the head, and every place I pay attention. Now, I've trained for this. Right, it's something that you go on a what we call a Goenka retreat, particular teacher, and this is what you do. Except I'm doing it in a much more streamlined way because I've practiced so much. After a while, my whole head becomes like a vibratory field. You know what happens when your arm goes to sleep? That tingling sensation. Well, that tingling sensation is going on all over the body, all the time, unceasingly. It's part of being alive. So I can be aware of that vibratory field in my head. Then I start to work down my neck, my shoulders. Typically, I'll go neck, shoulders, and then I'll jump to my fingers, my hands and my fingers. There are more nerve endings per cubic in the hands than a lot of places. The upper lip is the other place where there's a lot of sensation. So the fingers, hands, wrists, forearms, elbows, upper arm, shoulder, neck, head. In other words, I start moving my attention around that area, and that zone of vibration starts to permeate my torso. Move it down my chest, front and back of my chest, my ribs, my abdomen, small of my back, the buttocks, groin, thighs, knees, lower legs, feet, toes, so forth. And I just keep doing that systematically. And I can do that. Might take me 15 minutes on a retreat, maybe less than that after I've been doing it for a while. And I'll just hang out there. My whole body is like a vibratory zone. And at that point of practice, any intention or interest to observe anything other than that sensation kind of fades away. Mind rests in that without distraction. If there is some kind of thought process going on, I've used this image before. It's in the other room with the door closed. I assume that parts of my brain are always telling stories, always. Actually, there's the left temporal area is where that's usually located, or the right temporal area. So I'll hang out in there, and what happens when that goes on, I'm still trying to watch the breath while I'm doing this. So the sensation of breathing becomes integrated with that kind of awareness, whole body awareness. Mind becomes very quiet and open, and any interest in discerning where the body leaves off and the rest of the universe begins fades away. And so everything then becomes part of this field that's more or less undifferentiated, sounds, all that kind of stuff. And I just want to hang out there. And what happens is the out-breath becomes longer and quieter. It just kind of fades away. And then an in-breath will occur at some indeterminate period. And then just aware of that. And then the out-breath, just and the whole time, there's this zooming going on. And particularly with the out-breath, what I practice is surrendering any resistance, any preoccupation other than just doing that, just letting go, opening up, being curious, with a very stable, unhindered flow of attention.
Do you at any point count the breath?
No, don't do that. I did that when I first started, back in 1982. I haven't done it since. I haven't done it since my first retreat. I was told to do that on my first retreat, so that's what I did. But that kind of fell away during the retreat, and I haven't done it again. But it's a very honorable way to start your meditation practice. Even people who are quite experienced will do that. They'll count for a few minutes, or they'll practice metta, loving kindness meditation, for a few minutes, and then they'll go into mindfulness of breathing.
Yeah, that's what I noticed with my practice, that I need to count initially to really keep me focused, and then I start feeling that I no longer need the counting.
So that's in the same category as what I was suggesting to Mary. There's an intention to use some focal point that really is not terribly emotionally charged. You know, the sunset has a kind of a slight pleasant flavor to it, right? And that's good. It doesn't hurt. Numbers typically are very neutral, just like the breath. But it's cultivating the intention to investigate what's happening with the counting, with the breath, and you associate the numbers with the breath, and eventually you drop the numbers and you're just with the breath. So you numbers are sort of, or the that word is sort of like training wheels. So you get training wheels like a bicycle, you know, that you use until you can keep your balance, and then you just keep practicing.
For me, saying sunset would be confusing because it elicits an image, and then I'm like, okay, where am I going to concentrate? The image or on the breath?
Right. See, that wouldn't work for you then. But what works is the simplicity of the target. The target does not invite further chatter. It's just there, and it stabilizes your attention. And I'm saying this, I was on a retreat with Stephen Levine many years ago, and he made a suggestion during a guided meditation that I've found useful. Just imagine that you're sitting on one side of a railroad track, and there's a sign on the other side that says peace. And you start just focusing on that sign. And then a train comes through, right? Focusing on the sign is concentrating the mind. The train coming through is vipassana. And they're all flat cars. Some of them are empty, some of them are have objects on them. Everything's fine as long as you're aware of the sign that says peace, and you know that something's flowing through. But when you become fascinated with something that's on one of those flat cars, and your attention gets diverted, that's where craving and clinging takes over. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it could be counting, could be a special word. You know, in fact, when I mentioned that I started out meditation with the expanding, contracting of the abdomen, there's a very well-respected technique in that practice called noting. And you just simply tag very briefly what comes up in the mind with one word. Could be in-breath, could be out-breath. And then you notice that the mind jumps to a sound, sound, back to in-breath, right? So it's the same kind of thing. It's all about intention and learning how to train your attention intentionally to further your insight about how to liberate the mind from craving and clinging.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome.
Does your practice go
This
to
is Shayla for those of you who are tuning in via Zoom. Yes, Shayla?
Does your practice have the focus of like getting to emptiness, like not having the sensation or the illusion that there is a self
That's
inside
what
your
I'm
head?
looking for, dear.
Yeah, wondering about that.
Yeah, there's a term I often use that it's a very important Buddhist concept. It's called viraga, which is translated as dispassion. And dispassion is not emotional flatness. It's that the mind is so peaceful that it's relatively undisturbed no matter what's going on. And so what happens with that is interest in the mind forming a self starts to fade. I've often used the simile of what happens when your computer printer runs out of ink, right? The font just gets more and more faint. You can't read it anymore. Well, the storyline, the selfing story, gets fainter and fainter, like in the other room, and is less and less interesting. That's where I want to go. I'm going to be on retreat from the 19th to the 29th here, and that's my intended practice. It's just that what I was talking about with Val and in response to your question.
Don't you think it might be a little bit contradictory, like starting the practice guiding yourself to do something because what your focus, like let's say you like we put our intention, and this is like one of the things that I struggle a lot in the practice, right? Just trying to get to a point that is completely awareness. But it seems like we need to focus or put our attention into something. And while doing so, gets the sense of I'm doing that.
Right, that's
And
duality.
that's like
That's duality.
exactly. And
So
like
the
getting.
whole intention with viraga is to find a flow of experience that is not affected by there being an observer and that which is observed, which is opening to non-duality. And it's tricky. You know, your statement's very accurate. You get to a point where, you know, you're meditating and everything's steady and so forth and so on. There's still the notion that there's an observer or controller
Yeah,
that's making this
like we
happen.
need to guide the
Right.
attention
Right.
is.
Right. So that just starts to fade away. That opens to emptiness or non-self. And that's what I'm very interested in these days, is that.
Was there so like I know this is based in Buddhism, but like which tradition of Buddhism is it like
It's Mahayana or subset of Mahayana is Vajrayana. The Theravada is the oldest school. mostly focused on the impermanence of experience. It doesn't mean that anatta is not important. It's just that the doorway to awakening with Theravada is noticing the impermanence of self-experience. The Mahayana just puts more emphasis on the emptiness of it. They're not, one does not invalidate the other. There's just more emphasis on one than the other in the practice. And I was interested in impermanence for decades. In the last 5 years or so, I'm more interested in emptiness, in non-self as my practice. So I've been reading a book, some of you know this, called Seeing That Frees, Frees, Seeing That Frees. It's by a fellow, an Englishman named Rob Berbea. He was one of the teachers at the Gaia House in England. He's no longer alive, but that book really talks very importantly about emptiness, non-self.
Have
So
you?
that's going to be my resource, my reference book while I'm on the retreat here.
Have you getting to the study of, I don't know if I know how to pronounce it, but like there's a Buddhist tradition, Johnson, something?
Dzogchen.
Dzogchen, yes, that's the one that you said,
It's that's
Dzogchen.
it's very similar to Dzogchen, or what's also called Mahamudra. Those are Tibetan traditions. They're, like I said, there's Theravada, then Mahayana, and a subset of Mahayana is Vajrayana, which is Tibetan, and that's where the Dzogchen practice. And Dzogchen is just basically purified awareness, I guess you would say. Good questions. Great fun.
So you said 19 to 29.
Yeah.
So we're going to miss the 24th.
Yes. And then the first Dharma talk in January, I will talk about my experience, which is what we do when someone has a retreat. We have an opportunity for that person to think out loud about what happened during their experience.
I just keep increasing.
Christmas to me is abhorrent. The sentiment has been contaminated by greed and a lot of noise. So I plan my retreats this time of year so I don't have to deal with the Christmas nonsense, but also because it's the solstice. To me, the solstice is real. The relationship of the sun to the earth. It changes on the solstice, the winter solstice. And so I want to honor that. That's why I do that. I don't do it in the summer because it's too hot. But in the winter, yes, I love to do this. Other Dharma questions, practice questions? Robert?
Yeah, I don't. I've got to say, I don't even know if I'm meditating because I don't get on with mantra and I don't get on with watching the breath. I sort of tried it, and it doesn't work so well. But one thing I do is, or two things really is, what I do is I watch the mind collectively, what it's doing, you know, its movement and how it feels to me. Its busyness,
Feels in your body.
yeah, inside. So I observe the sensation of my mind moving, being busy, and I find that watching the whole like that, it starts to calm down if you watch it dispassionately. But then that tends to lead to doing what you said, the noting. And I find by just being detached, if you can do it, because it's not easy, because you can end up keep going off on the stories. But you can remain like you're watching a screen. And I have done that as well. So it might be a color comes up or a shape, or it might suddenly be a horse runs in, or and I just watch it. And if you hold to it, I find I get
Hold, you mean able to sustain that?
sustain it.
Yeah.
Eventually you
The
go,
word hold is a buzzword here.
is
We
it?
don't want to hold, we want to keep letting go.
Oh, I meant kind of stick to the actual
No, sticking
thought
doesn't work
process.
either.
Yeah, that
It's
doesn't work.
no, it's all about relinquishment, about letting go.
Yeah.
So using the word hold, or using the word stick, I mean, I'm kind of being nitpicky here, but it's to make a point that how we use intention, because the word stick or hold has some kind of network of associations in your mind,
Yeah.
right? So letting go is much more potent,
Yeah.
much more headed in the right direction than holding to the process.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sort of what I meant, really. I mean, it's about maintaining the detachment and maintaining the watching instead of, and then you think, oh, I'm not watching now.
Right.
And if you, I'm trying to find the right word, it's anyway, it works.
Good.
It's you kind of can almost slip into a sort of conscious dream state.
Well, that's not good.
No.
No. One of the problems with your approach, and I'm not saying your approach is wrong because millions of people do that. Part of what I think is Advaita Vedanta, which is part of the Hindu tradition, or Zen. Zen practice can be like that too. But the way you maintain the practice, as you're describing it, leaves the mind open to the hindrance of sloth and torpor. What's called sinking mind. It's like one of the characteristics of sloth and torpor is a dreamlike kind of experience. Now, if you are fully aware and detached and you know that dreaming is happening, that's different. But you really, your ability to pay attention has to be very discerning.
Yeah, that's what I mean, is that once you've stabilized the watching without going off on the stories,
Right.
you're watching this thing tends to stabilize and you get maybe one picture. I mean, another technique is whatever comes into the mind is to stick with that picture. So it's a street you know or something and just try and maintain that.
That's for concentration. That's not for insight.
These are just things I sort of try.
Yeah, that's fine. That's good. That's good practice. But
Yeah.
you know, my responses are is meant to help you, but also other people who are might be listening to this, that it's in that kind of practice, we're vulnerable to going into what I call cruise control. And that's when it starts to become, you know, everything's a dream. Everything is a dream. But when you start talking about, well, it kind of gets into a dreamlike state, that's probably sloth and torpor. That's not necessarily
Yeah.
being really present in a detached way.
It's not a sleep type state at all. It's just that maintaining, you suddenly maintain the watching. So whatever's coming in is
Maintaining
coming
the
in.
watching, that's
But
it.
the thing is that you can yeah, you can. It's like once you're not going with it, the mind sort of says, the mind says, oh, he's not playing the game anymore. So it tends to quiet down and there's a sort of stillness opens up. So that's the sort of thing that happens. That's the sort of thing that happens.
If that practice works for you, go for it. But be aware that it's easy for the mind to become very tranquil but sluggish and not particularly paying attention. When I do my self retreats, you know, I meditate, probably adds up to 8 or 10 hours a day, not in one shot. just see here for an hour, then I go to the recliner for an hour and back and forth and back and forth, break for meals and so forth. But generally, that's what I do from 5 in the morning till 10 at night. And when I go to bed, the dreams are really amazing. Very vivid dreams that I watch, just like you were talking about. You know, I've given up wondering, trying to make myself go to sleep. It's sort of like I have my own little private movie screen. You know, it's a dream state, and just kind of go along for the ride in that regard, with that same kind of intention of detached, interested awareness.
Yeah, I found that's a very good, easy way to get to sleep as well.
Sure.
So it's just to maintain the watching.
Without any fretting. And also, I also routinely move my attention through my body and make sure that there's no muscle tension.
Yeah, I do that as well. Because
Even when I'm sitting up and meditating.
it's like a two-way street. The mind sets up tensions in the body, but the body at the same time, with its tension, suddenly you find you're holding yourself in a certain way, and if you let it go,
Right.
that can work as well.
That quote that Mary was sharing with us, the word heart is there. And heart is the intersection or the interaction between the mind and sensations in the body. And I'm really big on the whole neuroscience part of it. There's this big nerve, the vagus nerve, that connects to the base of the brain, connects to the throat, the heart, the lungs, and the intestines. And so one part of the signal goes from the brain down to the body. Another part of that nerve complex signal goes from the body, all these different areas of the body, back to the brain. And so part of what I think what he's talking about with heart is this intersection between that, you know, the how experience kind of bounces back and forth or is woven in the fabric of mind and body. In fact, in Buddhism, there's a term, it's called nama rupa. Nama is name or what the mind makes, and rupa is sensation. And part of the practice is to be really clear about that intersection between what goes on in the body, how it affects the mind and the mind and how it affects the body in a detached way, an impersonal way. But this is what it's all about, is kind of dissolving the notion that there's a self that's running the show. Other questions? Mary.
So I wanted to ask more about your 10-day personal retreat. Are you totally by yourself the whole 10 days?
Yes. My dog might come to visit me,
I
but
was going to ask you about the dog.
oh yeah. When I move out here, I invite her to come with me so she knows I'm out here. And every once in a while, I will go for a walk after breakfast and after lunch, because it's important to have some exercise. And when I come back, she's often sitting by the chain link fence gate waiting for me. So she and I'll come in into the cottage here, and I'll pet her, and then she'll go. But yes, other than that, I'm by myself.
You talking to her?
Yeah, sometimes.
Oh, so it's not that style of pitch.
Well, no, well, it's not. When the silence is interrupted, there's an intention to it. A silent retreat might include interviews with a teacher, but the intention is there. And my intention with the dog is, it's just, we're not chatting. It's a different kind of vibe.
I know, I was kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, Peter.
Yes, ma'am. Sharon?
Yeah, on that theme, it would seem to me that I guess it's Mary who your dog or anybody, a human, any creature can be meditative and sit in silence with another creature
Well,
and be a part of.
she does that with
Pardon
me.
me?
She does that when I
Yeah.
meditate in first thing in the morning. My alarm goes off at 5 o'clock, and I get up and sit on the cushion for an hour. Well, as soon as she hears that bell, she comes in and lays down, and I interact with her for the first minute or so, and I say, "Okay, that's enough," and she goes away, and then she will come back. Sometime before the bell rings, the end of the sitting, she will be back in the room. She has some sense of time. And the same thing could
Yeah.
happen at night. So, yeah, it's interesting to watch that, my interaction with her and her whatever level of consciousness she has.
Well, and the other part of that is as you walk or as you are present with your routine, well, it's not even a routine with your silent retreat or just being present. I was biking around sunset today, and my attention went to the moon. We're just about in a full moon, maybe a day away, and my presence was very much I was just aware of my surroundings and aware of the moment. And I try to practice that in a variety of places and a variety of experiences. And I think the most challenging thing for me is to be in circumstances that are not quiet. And I know you've talked about it, and I've also tried to be present without getting maybe hooked on something if I'm in a different kind, a very different kind of environment where there's a lot of noise and distraction. And I, in fact, have a hard time when I go to an event and let's just say the event has a lot of noise and speakers. And when I say speakers, I'm talking about amplified noise. And it's like layer upon layer of noise. And I try to practice in those circumstances, and it's really pretty challenging to not let's just say to be more equanimous in those circumstances.
Right, but that could become interesting. You see, it could be rather than having to endure a situation, you transform it into a game, right? And it's not as though you're going to either win or lose the game. It's just that there's a certain kind of procedure that you do that frees the mind from some kind of reactivity or goal. Your goal is to be in the vertical, to be present. And as you're saying this, you've heard me say this before, Sharon. The very well-respected teacher Ajahn Chah was talking about being outside of a village, as he was a forest monk, was basically living under a tree. And there was a festival in this village, and they had some very cheap amplifiers. very lousy speaker system, and they were playing songs pretty much 24 hours a day during this festival. And he was going to go down and chastise them. You know, I'm a holy man. Why are you doing this to my practice? And then he realized, and this is what the sticking point is, or the liberating point, rather. I realized that the sound wasn't disturbing my mind. My mind was disturbing the sound. See, that's that nama rupa. You know, rather than the two getting tangled up in each other, there's just something that's impacting the auditory process, and the brain is doing something with it. And that something can either be creating a lot of distress and confusion, or it can just simply be present moment without reactivity. But the idea is to learn how
Yeah.
to drop into that. That's the training, is to learn how to drop into that. You become more able to do it with practice.
Well, yes, and I consider that to be a serious practice, off the cushion, a very serious practice. And I'm not sure how to call, at this stage in, I call it the home stretch of life. The third act, whatever you want to call it. But because of the, it seems like things are different. And they probably always have been, but I'm practicing being mindful, being present, being in the moment, being all of that. And, more than I ever have, probably in any concerted in any concerted way. I have been very present, but I wasn't thinking about it in those terms. I was just very engaged in whatever I was doing. But now it's an awareness that this is what my intentions are to be aware.
So, Sharon, you and I have talked about your practice for many years. And based on what you're saying and what you've, I've heard, other things I've heard you say recently, you're getting it.
Slowly but surely and steady, yeah, steadily I am, it's an effort. It is a goal. It is an intention. It's many things, and it's really important.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And for me, it's not so much the goal as it is the journey. You know, it's very interesting
Okay.
to engage
Yeah.
my life in this way with some degree of frequency. I'm not like that all the time, but more and more often it occurs to me in any given situation, drop into the breath, drop into the body, let go, open up, stop fighting. Just be present. And I find that it's fun.
Right. Thank you.
Other questions, comments?
Can I just ask again about your practice you have here, the
Yeah.
10 days
Yeah.
you do here? So you awake at 5,
Uh-huh.
and then you're meditating basically all day apart from going for a walk.
Well, here's the routine. I used to sit for 2 hours at a time. For some reason, my body really doesn't work very well. Maybe it'll be able to do it on the retreat because of the routine. But basically, I get up at 5 and I sit. I used to get up at 4 and
Yeah,
sit till
I've heard
6.
that's a good time to have something to do with the
And I might do that again. I don't know.
prana.
But, I sit for one period of time, I'll just say for an hour, and I'll try to stay mindful as I prepare and eat breakfast, and stay mindful while I'm walking. I'll walk for half an hour or so after a meal,
Outside in the street.
outside, yeah, in the neighborhood. And then I'll come back and I'll sit on the recliner after I get back from the walk for an hour, and then I'll come back in here and sit for an hour until, do it back and forth till noon. And then I'll eat lunch mindfully and go for another walk and come back and just alternate sitting and walking for until 10 o'clock. No meals after that, after lunch. Now, what I'm thinking of doing this time is not something I've done in a long time, which is to, because I'm not sitting for 2 hours, to try to be very mindful, slowly walking from sitting on the cushion over to the recliner. It might take me a half an hour to get there and never stop moving. That's a slow walking meditation, and still be doing what I was doing when I sitting practice, trying to do that as I'm moving through the room, through the building, and then same coming back to the cushion. But when I've fixed the meal, I'm not going to be doing it slowly. When I go for a walk outside, I'm not going to be doing that slowly. But I'm going to try to integrate whatever level of mind-body integrated awareness I can while I'm fixing a meal and while I'm walking, using the slower practice, the more deliberate practice, otherwise, just to kind of build that momentum.
So you bring all your food in for the 10
Oh yeah,
days.
I just move out here.
Do you strictly stick to certain foods and not other foods?
Yeah, foods that I've been a vegetarian except for eggs for half my life. And I just prepare very simple meals that I can get this little package of rice that takes 90 seconds to heat.
Right.
I can eat oatmeal, I can eat eggs, peanut butter and jelly, easy things, and just keep doing that because it's simpler and it becomes part of my practice.
You have coffee and things like that.
Tea.
Tea.
I drink tea. I have tea at my bedside table. So I drink it the first thing in the morning when I get up to meditate, and drink tea for lunch. And
Sorry to be specific, it's really interesting to me. Is that green tea or is it
no, it's
black tea?
caffeinated black tea.
Black tea, yeah, that's my
There's
pattern.
some legend that suggests that the first tea cultivation was started by Chinese Buddhist monks in Southwest China, which is where it was, I think, where they discovered tea. Of course, Southwest China could also be Vietnam, Laos, whatever, that whole area, Southeast Asia. Excuse me, Southwest China, not Southeast China. Other questions about practice or the doctrine? Well, I'm going to assume that that's all we're going to cover tonight. It's our custom at the end of our meeting to for us to sit together in silence briefly. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. I hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.